I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. This is Michael Veazey with Amazing FBA, and today we have my lovely accountant and very wise lady, Penny Lowe from Wellington Consulting, who knows all about Amazon accounts, partly from looking at my attempts at keeping records, which have been sometimes more or less successful. So today, Penny, welcome back, first of all, and we're going to be looking at people and the problems they hit with their accounting and bookkeeping and the solutions to those for people who are trying to scale up from doing a few thousand dollars a month to sort of doing the tens and even of hundreds of thousands a month. So the first question is, what are the big problems you come across with people who've got bigger turnover and or are scaling up fast?
I think that one of the biggest problems is the stock control, that where you've got an increased number of units going out, it's trying to keep track of which ones are on the water, which ones are in the warehouse, what's happening to the quality of them, and making sure that's kept up, and what's happening to the faulty products. You've also got issues with redundant stock. What are you going to do with the items that you're no longer going to be distributing? Because usually, as time moves on, so your product range will change. What happens to the old ones? Are they sitting in the warehouse costing you rent every month? Or have you made a decision that you're no longer going to ship them and dumped them? Or, you know, because you don't necessarily want to just sell at a discount. Otherwise, people might want some more. So there may be other avenues that you need to look at to get rid of the dead or obsolete stock.
Excellent. Okay. So obsolete stock sitting around, I guess, is going to be expensive in storage rates. And it's particularly true in the US now. They've recently changed their storage rates in Amazon.com, so in the US, because of precisely this. I guess they are also... They're not really building much extra capacity. So yeah, the actual storage space is getting more and more valuable, and the cost of that is deliberately they're pushing it up. So they don't want you, they're in a way forcing you to make a decision by a sort of financial penalty almost to, you know, sell the stock or move it in some way or get rid of it. So that makes sense, and that ties in with what Amazon wants. And when you tie in with what Amazon wants, it tends to work well for us as well. So let's look at the attribution of direct costs and things like that quite a lot in detail in the previous episode. So what are the other main issues that come up with people who are scaling up or doing more significant turnover?
I think one of the big things is if your turnover is getting near 85,000, you need to keep an eye on it from the point of view of VAT. In the UK at the moment, 85,000 is the turnover limit. That if your turnover exceeds that, you need to register for VAT. Even if you're selling abroad, you still need to register for VAT, and you might find that you're in a position where you can claim some VAT back if stuff's being imported into the UK but sold overseas. And also, you've really got to keep an eye on it, because if you don't and you find yourself, you know, 90,000, 100,000, the tax man can come along and say, oh, well, although you haven't charged customers or put your prices up to include the VAT, we want the money anyway. So that can be an unexpected bill if you're not monitoring the figures.
Yeah, well, that's that would be an ugly scenario. And I think I haven't really come across that a lot with Amazon sellers, but I can imagine you that would very easily happen, actually, because then that's the worst case scenario, really, isn't it? So thank you for that warning. So then the other things are, so we talked about VAT. Tell me a bit more about VAT. We've looked at VAT in the UK, which I guess is fairly straightforward. If you're doing £85,000 a year in turnover, then you have to register anyway. And I wouldn't probably suggest to most people in the business and consumer space that they register prematurely for VAT before they have to. Would you concur with that thinking, or have you got any other thoughts on that?
No, I'd agree that, you know, you find it in a lot of small businesses that if they register for VAT, they've got to potentially add their 20% to the goods that they're selling to hand over to the tax man, which makes them more expensive than somebody who hasn't registered with a similar turnover.
Yeah, and also I have to say in the Amazon space, there's the added game that there's a lot of Chinese sellers and some US sellers that are selling in Europe who theoretically should be registered for VAT but just aren't. That's a reality. You can now shop them on HMRC. We should probably put the link in the show notes, actually. There's a place where you can go to and shop people you think should be VAT registered but aren't. But, you know, that's a bit like King Canute in the sea. There's a lot of them out there. So I guess, yeah, you're right. There's no point in fighting with one hand behind our back. So let's tell us a bit more about Europe and VAT. So obviously, it's quite quick and easy to sell into Germany from UK. And I do it already using the European Fulfillment Network, which basically means you send stuff into a fulfillment center in the UK. And then you can list the stuff on Amazon.de. And then if somebody in Germany on Amazon buys that stuff, it just gets fulfilled from the UK. So are there any sort of accounting or VAT implications around that, first of all?
You need to keep an eye on how much you're selling in these countries, because each of the countries in Europe have a different turnover limit before you need to register. So if you find yourself doing, you know, £50,000 worth of trade in Germany, you would need to register for VAT in Germany. So you do need to keep an eye on that. So it depends which country as to what the figures are. But if you're doing a lot of turnover to one country, that's when you may need to register in that country.
Makes a lot of sense. So is that around the distance selling fees? Is that the relevant sort of legislation or tax regime that kicks in there?
Yes, it's to do with the distance selling rules. If you are selling digital items abroad as opposed to physical items abroad, then you would need to register and do mini one-stop shop, as it's called, which is a return regardless of turnover as to how much you're selling across Europe. And that's for digital sales only.
Okay, interesting. Well, that's certainly worth bearing in mind for people who sell online courses, which will be me. But when it comes to Amazon sellers, as they're selling physical products, if it's below a certain turnover, we don't have to register and we don't have to pay tax. Is that right?
When you say tax, we're talking about
VAT tax.
Sales tax, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, if I import something from China to the UK, I'm going to have to pay VAT on the import side of it. But I'm talking about, yeah, the sales tax. So yes. What are the distance selling VAT thresholds for the five Amazon marketplaces, which I guess, well, if you're in the UK, it's not distance selling, so it's £85,000 turnover for VAT. Yeah. What are the distance selling ones in Germany, France, Italy, Spain, if you happen to know off the top of your head, or if not,
no, I don't.
A rough idea. So Germany, you mentioned, it was over £50,000. Is that right?
I'm not sure of the exact figure. Okay. I need to check on the figure.
Oh, that's fine. I'm putting you on the spot here. My understanding of the latest figures was something like €35,000 for most of those places. And fortunately in Germany, €100,000. So, but they do change all the time. We'll put links in the show notes to those anyway, but just wondered if you knew off the top of your head, sorry, putting you on the spot rather unfairly there. So once you get VAT registered in Europe, are there any particular things that you would have to mention about this? I mean, it's a very specialist area, so I'm not going to put you on the spot with lots of detail about that. But are there any sort of general principles that would apply?
The main thing is when you need to do returns as to how much you've sold, make sure you get them in good time. In the same way, any payments due, remember that not all banks work at the weekends, and if you want to avoid fines and penalties, make sure that you don't leave it till the last day when a payment is due to put that in, because it might be 6 o'clock at night, but the bank's closed at 4:30. So that's one thing to beware of as far as VAT in Europe or VAT in the UK or yeah. Any taxes, really. That's the main thing I would say.
Okay. I mean, yeah, and VAT for foreign selling is a very, very specialist thing. And I guess you probably do need a specialist accountants firm to deal with that. And we may interview somebody around that. But I would say for anyone starting off, that's not relevant. But for this more advanced episode, for other more advanced sellers, and tell me a little bit more about any other VAT things that might apply in Europe that come from your experience. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not expecting you to be absolutely an expert on VAT for Amazon sellers in Europe, because that's very, very hyper specialized. But what's any other broader thoughts about that?
Really, if you are VAT registered and you are purchasing goods from Europe, even if you're going to then ship them back out again, as the stuff comes into the UK and it clears customs, you would have to pay the VAT as it lands in the UK. And there is a form, which I believe is a C79, which is a green form, that revenue will send you, and you have to hang on to them because they're proof of the fact you paid VAT. So that's one thing to bear in mind. In the same way, if you are shipping stuff out of the UK, you need to be able to prove that it's left the country. So if you're using a shipment centre that's shipping it for you, that's fine. You can waive their dockets under the taxman's nose. But if you're starting to ship stuff yourself or using couriers, it's not just the bill from the courier that you need to keep. It's the paperwork with the shipment numbers, etc. Okay. One other point when exporting, if you are starting to export to other countries, have a look at the list of restricted products. So, for example, Nigeria, you can't export furniture to Nigeria. There's lots of other things you can't export to Nigeria either. But those are some of the sorts of things. It's just worth having a look and seeing whether there are any restrictions as to what you can send out to a particular country, because you don't want to get stung for penalties and the like, or set up a business selling something and then find the whole business collapses because you've sold something to a country that won't allow you to export to that country.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, although I would imagine that in Amazon there is quite a degree of unity, and particularly as it is currently famously still in a customs union, although we'll see how that is in 2019. But there are restricted product lists on Amazon, and obviously if it's in German, then you just need to make sure you get that translated, and you could just use Google Translate these days, or set the Google auto-translate sort of widget at the top of the page. But yeah, it is worth double-checking that, particularly in some countries like Germany. There's all sorts of extra legislation in Germany that nobody else in the world has. So I would suggest that if you're selling in Germany, that's a worthwhile thing to check. So thanks for that thought. Any other sort of major topics for people selling at this level? You've mentioned cash flow to me as something that we ought to address. Tell me about the sort of cash flow issues that people can get at this stage of scaling up.
Yes, I've seen businesses suffer terribly with it, or with lack of cash. The challenge is that particularly if you're buying in China, etc., they like the money, at least some of it up front with order, the rest before it gets put on the boat. If it's then on the boat for a number of weeks before it actually lands, you've had to shell out all the money, but the income won't start happening yet. Even when it gets to Amazon, you've actually got to sell the product before you start getting money for it. So you've got another delay there while it goes through any quality controls, etc., that happen at the Amazon site if they're doing that sort of shipment and checking for you. So between making the first payment for the goods and getting the money back for the goods can be an awful long time. And again, I've seen experience where the stuff's taken 6 weeks to get from China to the UK. And, you know, it was ordered 2 months before. So, you know, you're ready into 3.5 months, then sits at the docks for another few weeks before it actually goes to the warehouse, before actually getting shipped to customers. So all that period of time, you've got to fund it. And as the business grows, if you've got half a dozen product lines, which are all on the water, you've had to find the money for all of that before you can get it back again. So that's one thing I would say with cash flow. One way around this that some banks, etc., would suggest is called factoring. And that's most particularly where you are selling to businesses, and there's quite a time frame between when you issue your sales invoice and when the customer actually settles the bill. Because we're selling through Amazon, payment terms are going to be reasonably fast. So you shouldn't really need to worry about factoring. But if you do think about it, find out the costs, build them into your selling price, because it is not a cheap way of getting money ahead of getting the money from the customers.
Yeah.
Same way with finance. You know, don't use your bank overdraft to fund it. If you do need to have a business loan, make sure that you've got plenty of time to pay it back, and you're not doing a sort of hills and valleys approach of getting all the money in, then just as the money's coming in, you're going, I have to pay it all out again. So you do need that money there.
Okay, so basically, in other words, factoring, I mean, I suspect that factoring is probably not a viable option for a lot of us because the percentage that they take is so big that probably wipes out most sort of, if it's going to be 10, 15%, then that'll wipe out a lot of the profit margins we'd make on products, which are typically 20 to 30% range. And that said, yeah, long-term bank load sounds like a good solution if you can persuade your bank. Now, I know that that is a difficult thing to get out of a bank for e-commerce, even though it's a growing sector versus retail, which is dying off in the high street brick and mortar retail. One solution to that is Matt Ward has come up with, for example, who we've got, funnily enough, we're interviewing next for the show, who's come up with a special funding based on his debt funding, basically based around taking a percentage of revenue. So any thoughts on that and or bank loans? Like how do we get ourselves a little bit of more capital to invest or to deal with the cash flow issue produced by the business model?
Yes, when you're talking about that type of loan where the repayments are based on sales revenue, percentage of sales revenue, I've got a pub in particular who sometimes does that with her VAT bill instead of putting money aside. It's like, yeah, need the money now. And basically, they take a percentage of the card takings to repay the loan. But if you actually look at how long that might be, it's very, very, or can be very expensive to do. Because until you get your takings, you're not repaying the loan. You've just got this increasing amount of interest. And because the repayments fluctuate based on your sales, you don't actually know when you're ever going to pay that loan off. And all that time, it's accumulating interest. So tread gently if that's going to be the sort of loan or offer. Another method is where you are guaranteeing a loan. So you go along to your bank with your limited company and say, I'd like this money, please, on a 6 months basis. And they will say, oh, you know, where are your sales coming from? And what you can say is, well, you know, I've got the house, or you might have a family member who can act as a guarantor for you on that loan. And that may be one way that you can get the money. But it's got to be paid back at the end of the day, because if you don't pay it back, your guarantor will be paying it back for you. So make sure it's friendly and they're aware of what you're signing up to.
Yeah, the personal guarantee thing is a scary thing. I think most business loans in America seem to work that way from what I can gather as well. So personal guarantees is a scary thing, but it's one of those things where you've got to look at the increased risk and how ambitious you are and weigh that up, I guess. Now, another more mundane question, but which turns up a lot around company law versus, you know, how you get your money out of your company. The difference between directors and shareholders, because sometimes people can get a bit confused, if you can just address that for a second for us.
Yes, a director is an individual, or can be a business, but we'll just stick to individuals for the moment, that is registered at Companies House as being in control of the company. So they have the day-to-day responsibility for making sure that it's doing legal things and working for the benefit of its investors. So the investors are the shareholders. They're the people that put money in. Now, when you start up a business, it may only be a pound that you need to put in, but the fact that you've invested some money in the business is in the hope of getting returns. So your shareholders aren't necessarily the directors. It may be, again, other family members or other parties who have put up some money and are not expecting it by way of a loan, but can see a good future going forward and would like a percentage of the profits of the business going forwards. So when you're talking about directors and shareholders, they can be totally different people. In a small business, they usually start off being the same. I'm going to set a company up, I'm the director, and I'm having 100% of the profits, being 100% of the shares. But as you move forward, and again, it may just be staff as you get larger, that you want to incentivize your staff. So you might give them 2 or 3% of the total shares. So they're entitled to 2 or 3% of the profits from the business. So again, if you're starting to do that, speak to somebody who understands it before you start handing out shares willy-nilly, because I would always encourage a shareholders agreement. So if that member of staff leaves or moves on or retires, you know whether you can buy the shares back, or if they stay with you for 3 months, you've given them some shares, then they move on to a competitor. as a shareholder, they'd be entitled to the accounts to see how the business is doing, and they'd still be entitled to a share of the profit because they're shareholders. So you would still be handing over some money each year to them as a share of that profit. So if you have got shareholders that aren't just you, make sure you have a shareholders agreement to cover things like what happens if, and whether you have the right to buy back shares from them, or you have the first option to buy back shares from them, and how the company would be valued at that point, so that you know in advance how you're going to decide how much you'd have to pay for that share.
That's a very, very important point that I hadn't really considered at all. And partly because I haven't had outside investors in my personal businesses, although I know quite a few people that do get involved in that over time as businesses scale. How would all those things apply in the sense of a business partnership, not in the legal sense of a partnership, but if, you know, I've got a company that I own 50% of and I'm a director of, along with a business partner who also owns 50% of the company's shares and is a director. Is it a good idea? Is it necessary to have a shareholders agreement in that sort of situation?
My suggestion would be yes. And the reason I say that is if one of you were to become unwell and not able to work in the business, would the other one feel aggrieved that that first party was still getting 50% of the profits? So that's one reason why. So you've got things like ill health, falling out, which I always hope you won't do, death, divorce, all sorts of reasons. Because if you've got 50% of a business, or two of you've got 50% of a business, and one of you ends up getting divorced, you might find that the other party to the divorce says, yeah, my other half has got a business, I want 50% of that business. And that's then 50% of the 50%. But that can then become very complicated if you haven't got any form of agreement as to how that's going to be valued and that sort of thing. Estate and death is one of those things that you can't avoid. You just hope it never happens. But again, you know, should something happen to the other party of the business, it's much cleaner for everybody if you have got some sort of agreement. And what you may choose to do from a simplistic point of view is if one of the two parties wants to withdraw from the business, that the other one has the option to buy their shares at, you know, 25% reduction or whatever in the value of those shares, so they don't automatically get sold on to somebody else without your control over those shares.
Yeah, that's a very wise thing. And I suppose I would always assume that that would be the way out of a business partnership. And I do know if it's within the form of a limited company. And I do know somebody in a mastermind that I run that had, you know, reasonably small business, but actually quite quickly grew. And he was talking about selling his share of the business buying his business partner out, and then actually suddenly it turned out the other way and he sold his half of the business to the business partner and disappeared from my group because he, you know, got out of the game with a nice profit. So I guess that needs to be not assumed and built into some agreement there from what you're saying.
Yes, I think the agreement is a starting point. You know, you can always be friendly and say, you know, I'll give you an extra 25% to buy you out. No harm in that sort of thing. But having something there means that if there is a parting of the ways for whatever reason, including ill health, because that for me is a big one, that if somebody is unwell for a period of time and can't work in the business, you know, how are you going to go forward? As I say, it's just one of those things that I've seen happen where what happened on that one is one of the people said, oh, I'll just waive my share of dividends. And that was all very well. But then the tax man would say, well, what justification is there? Does that mean that you actually, this should be salary and not dividends because you're working in the business, otherwise you wouldn't be waiving it? And there were just too many questions. So in the end, it was like, well, take the dividends and then give them back net of tax to the first individual. But that's the sort of thing that I would rather have things written down while things are going good. And then you've got something there if things go bad.
Yeah, it's a good point about contingency planning. And we haven't quite got time to go into how to value a business, but I guess you're going to have to come up with some way of doing that for the shareholders agreement as well. But I guess to sort of wrap this one up, one other question that comes up quite a lot, which I just want to just briefly talk about, salary versus dividends. If you want to take money out of the business, is there a preferable way of doing it? And if so, what's the thinking there?
Right. I believe there should be some salary taken by the director who's doing the work, partly to keep the tax man happy, because if you are putting effort into the business, you know, you should be recognised for that effort. And if it's going through a salary, it is a legitimate expense of the business, so there's no problems there. It reduces your tax bill on the business. But what it also does is, if it is your only source of income, it means if your salary is in the region of sort of $8,500 from the business a year, then you are getting your national insurance credits towards your pension. Now, at the moment, you might say, I'm making pots of money, I won't need to worry about the state pension, but there might be other entitlements that you do need. And if, again, if your health starts to fail, it's useful to have that as a backstop, to know that you've been paying into the state and therefore they can help look after you in your latter days. Once you start getting above $8,500, you're going to have to start paying a touch of national insurance, but not a huge amount. And that's on a per job basis. So if you've got another employment, the national, which is over $8,500 a year, alongside your Amazon business, then you might find that you're paying national insurance there. That doesn't matter. You then don't need such a big salary out of your Amazon business. But have some, ideally have some salary, partly to keep the tax man happy. If you're making huge sums, then you'll be looking at taking out the profits after corporation tax by way of dividends. At this time, the rules have just changed, so it's only £2,000 of dividends you can have tax-free, and then the rest of them get added to your other income to find out whether you're paying tax at 20%, you know, 40%, 45%. It would depend on what turnover you're doing. But again, by having other shareholders, it may be that you can distribute your profits to incentivize them and to reduce your tax bill. So that's a bit of tax planning depending on your circumstances, really.
Yeah, I guess the final piece that comes out for me from this interview is just a reminder, having talked to you, you know, once again, talking to you now about this, that there are many nuances that I wouldn't even think I should think about, if you see what I mean, when it comes to certain questions like that. And actually, I think what it comes down to a lot of the time is, you know, they can be good general advice, and thank you so much for your general advice, and very, very helpful too. But it does come down to finding a good accountant. So if people want to get in touch with you, Penny, and work with you, or just get some advice from you, how would they be able to follow you? Would they be able to follow you on social media or any blogs or anything like that? Or is it just a question of getting in touch and book you for a session as an accountant?
Really, it's a case of getting in touch. I do odd bits of social media, but as we're doing today, it has to be general advice. So, you know, a one-to-one conversation, either over the phone, or I tend to use GoToMeeting if you want face-to-face, or show me what's on your computer screen, I can do that. I'm actually based in Hereford, or near Hereford, Ross on Wye, but, you know, clients all over the country. And you know, sometimes a few of them I've never met. Others I've happened to call in when we're passing, or they've done the same and been to visit me here. So I do a lot of work, you know, not distance selling, but distance accounting. So, you know, if people want to have that conversation, you know, find me by searching on Wellington Consulting or Penny Lowe. You know, contact details are on the websites. They can see what
you can do. We will definitely, of course, put your contact details and links on this, the show notes for this episode as well. So, yeah, just a reminder, folks, really, that there is no substitute for a conversation with an expert in a certain area. And actually, accountancy involves so many areas. Eventually, you're probably going to want to have an expert in European VAT registration and European tax and American sales tax and whatever else. But, I mean, Penny's a very good starting point, and you need to start with someone with a bigger picture overview, I think, in order to even tell you what specialists you should book. So, Penny, it's been very, very educational as ever. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your wisdom with us poor Amazon sellers struggling with our figures out here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and can I wish you all every success in your businesses.
Thank you very much, Penny. Very gracious of you. And yes, thank you very, very much for coming on. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.